550 we will hold off on. Today, we're A, waiting for amendment, and B, need to see if all four parts can hang together. So we'll hold off on 550. Start on 3201 and probably recess this morning and come back to 3201. There's a number of amendments that are being drafted to that bill, and so we'll just start listening to that right now. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3201, and Representative Barker is just so eager to, this is the most eager I've have had someone to testify that I'm tempted to just talk here for a second.
Mr. Chair, you should come to Judiciary sometime.
And General Caldwell, if you want to join him to talk about the base bill, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jeff, for the record, Jeff Barker, State Representative, House District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. And I'm in a hurry because I need to be on the floor in a few minutes here.
We might have a lot of questions on this.
that's why my good friend, the General, is here to answer them for you. This bill, we're trying to increase the suppression for active duty compensation for the Oregon Guard from $3,000 to $6,000. The families, these men are, and women are going away and often leaving better paying jobs to perform their duties for the country. And it's a financial hardship on many of them. And so that was kind of the reason for that. As you know, since we don't have a draft anymore, we're depending on fewer and fewer citizens to actually serve in the armed forces, and we're having them serve over and over again. And the people who sign up for one weekend a month and 2 weeks a year have found out that's not how it works anymore. And then we have also asking for a credit for physicians who provide medical care to residents of the Oregon Veterans Home. There's part-time physicians that work there. We want to encourage more physicians to have the absolute best care we possibly can for the people in the Veterans Home over in the Dalles. And there's, by the way, another bill we're working on to create a second Veterans Home. There's 370,000 veterans in Oregon, so there's a need for that. And also, we're looking to get some credit for those serving on active duty. They're helping in the Oregon Youth Challenge Program over in Central Oregon. Talked to some of the kids, got letters from the kids that have gone through that program. It's really turned lives around and really worthwhile. And we really appreciate the Senate considering these same amendments we brought out of the House Veterans Committee this year.
Great. Thank you, Representative Barker. I would encourage questions of Representative Barker at this point.
My good senator.
He's dying to get out of here for General Caldwell. Thank you, Representative.
And I do need to run and be up on the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Brigadier General Mike Caldwell, Deputy Director at the Military Department, and a good representative stated the basic fundamental tenets of the bill very well. I would just add that the $3,000 amendment that is currently in the statute is being moved to $6,000. That was put in 1971 by the legislature. Had it maintained inflationary values since 1971, that deduction would be at $14,000 today or roughly. So this is, I think, a modest step in trying to do what it, you know, what I think the original intent of the legislation was to, you know, try to benefit these men and women who volunteer. And if you think back in 1971, that was just at the close of the draft, and the volunteer service army was just starting up. Obviously, wages and or tax deductions in this case have not maintained pace with the with everything else. The other pieces of it, was well spoken to the Veterans Home. I would add that Youth Challenge Program, we have 48 employees currently employed at the Youth Challenge Program. We run two classes per year, 150 kids are invited each class. We just had a graduation 2 days ago for, it's a 22-week program for the group that's graduating here this month. We graduated 108. It's voluntary. It's high school dropouts. Our problem is that we ended up in a DOD site that was formerly a black site out in the desert 9 miles east of Bend, because it was a free site, basically. The cost of living in Bend.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
What is a black site?
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, black site is a secret site. It was a site that was used by the Department of Defense to do some work that we don't have any knowledge of, I guess, at this point, but it was Cold War oriented. When the Cold War ended, the site was no longer needed, so it was shut down. and it became excess to the federal government, to the Department of Defense. And that's how we ended up there, basically. It's a 58,000-square-foot building. Inside of the building is a raised computer floor of about 5,000 square feet, totally encased in steel, to give you an idea of just a visual image. It's something you'd see probably in a movie. Works real well for classrooms, though. And it says fully contained kitchen, billets, medical facilities, office support, a classroom, a big, what we call a drill floor area where you can exercise, and et cetera. So it's, and it's got its own water, its own energy production, heat, everything else. So, and it's on 170 acres of BLM land that's been extracted from the BLM. And it provides a great place to put trails for kids to go out and exercise. So it's a really, and I certainly invite any of you over there at any time. We'd love to have you over. We've had many people from the legislature come over and look, see, feel, touch, ask the kids the questions, and we'd certainly encourage you to do that. The cost of living has become such in Bend that we've had a terrible time maintaining fairly low-end type jobs that are really important to us, cadre jobs that, you know, help keep the kids. It's basically a high school. We run a high school, and we are certified as a high school. But there's another component to it, 24/7, where you got to have management and people around to do that. We've got a 48% turnover in our staff, in our line staff. Professional staff, leadership, and the teachers don't turn over very much, but everybody else does. And a good deal of the reason for that is because of the high cost of living in Bend. They just go get a better job. So this tax deduction is very important to us, we think, to keep these people in state employment and keep them in our program. Consistency is real important for these kids as well. And we're turning over that many people. It's just, it's costly for training, it's, you know, and we haven't found another solution. So we're looking for this as a possible solution. So that's why this bill is real important to us, for those enumerated reasons. And I'd be more than willing to answer any questions you have. And if I can encourage you to just pass this thing out, I'd be great. But I'd certainly be able to answer any of your questions.
Questions for General Caldwell. Yes, Senator George.
Why would you allow a relating clause like this to be?
Mr. Chairman, Senator George, you know, I didn't have anything to do with that. You'd have to walk down, go out here, take a right, go down a few doors and take another right. Talk to those certified smart lawyers, okay? I don't know anything about that.
Other questions for General Caldwell? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Chris, anything we need to know? We're going to return to this this bill as and Paul, as soon as we start getting amendments, if we can make those public. So far, I don't think we've received any back. Okay, so we're just waiting for amendments to 3201, but now have the base bill behind us. Anyone else just on the veterans portion of 3201? Okay. Close public hearing on House Bill 3201 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3057. Chris, you have worked very hard on this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3057 addresses the medical provider taxes. Part of what it does, it extends the sunsets for the taxes. It extends the long-term care facility tax sunset date from July 1, 2008 to July 1, 2014, and the repeal date from January 09 to January 2015. It also extends the hospital and Medicaid managed care tax sunset dates from January 1, 2008 to October 1, 2009, and the repeal dates from January 2010 to January 2012. It also ensures that the hospital tax sunsets if the Medicaid managed care tax no longer qualifies for federal matching funds. That's not expected to happen, but if that upon that condition, the hospital tax would sunset also at that time. It also removes language pertaining to the tax on programs of all-inclusive care for elderly persons. Now, part of the background of these taxes is that they are used to leverage federal funds, and part of the requirements to receive those federal funds is that these taxes be broad-based. And the programs on all-inclusive care never really met those criteria, so it never got off the ground, so the language is just being repealed. Other changes to the hospital tax include the maximum rate being reduced from 3% to 1.5%. That doesn't have a measurable effect. Right now, the tax rate is at 0.8%, so that doesn't have a real effect on anything. It also allows the Department of Human Services to develop a schedule for collections for assessments for the calendar quarter ending September 30th, 2009 that allows sufficient time to finalize Medicaid cost settlements. Basically, in the bill, the tax would sunset on October 1, 2010, and most of the money would be collected in that time. These Medicaid cost settlements, however, can take some time to settle. They're not a large part of that money, but that piece of the bill would just allow sufficient time for those costs to be settled. The bill also allows DHS to write rules to identify criteria for late penalty assessments. These would be, the idea here is if something were to happen, some sort of natural disaster or something where some of the entities couldn't submit the tax payments on time, it allows DHS the flexibility to address late penalty assessments. It also clarifies that the hospital tax revenue is to be used just for hospital services and for increasing reimbursement rates above those in effect on February 29, 2004. A lot of these are clarifications and not major policy changes. We'll get to in the long-term care facility tax or a couple of policy impacts. But that was it for the hospital tax. With respect to the long-term care facilities tax, the bill clarifies that for the purposes of determining the assessment rate, gross revenue does not include hospital revenue or revenue from sources other than long-term care facility operations. Again, just a clarification of existing practices, not a change in policy. It also clarifies that the definition of Medicaid patient days for purposes of applying the assessment date. It clarifies that the financial statements or revenue reports be used when establishing the assessment rate. And again, those are just clarifications, not changes in policy. Extends by 3 months the time DHS has to refund overpayments to taxpayers, just allowing additional time there. It also reduces the Medicaid reimbursement rate from the current 70th percentile to of allowable cost to the 63rd percentile. And this was a key policy change that was the result of many negotiations that have occurred over the past few months. So that was a key piece, key policy piece. And the bill also allows DHS to reduce the effective assessment rate from 6% to 5.5% beginning January 1, 2008, and that's to comply with federal law, which has that change that is already scheduled to be reduced. It also removes the tax from the jurisdiction of the Oregon Tax Court, so any dispute resolution would be handled outside the Oregon Tax Court. And then the last piece with respect to the Medicaid managed care taxes, it just clarifies that the revenue from that tax cannot be used to replace other funding for the identified services, basically so that the tax is used as a supplement to the services, not to backfill other revenue. And then you also have a revenue impact statement. The numbers come from DHS, and for 2007-09, the extension of the sunset dates would raise $220 million in other funds for 2007-09 and $120 million in 2009-11. And part of the reasons for the varied patterns there is that the long-term care tax would consist of a one-year extension in 07-09 and a full two-year extension in 09-11. So that's the reason the number doubles there. The sunset date is pushed out to 2014. And for the hospital and MCO taxes, the impact is for 18 months in 07-09, carrying it through the current biennium, and then just 3 months into the 09-11 biennium where it sunsets. And that's the reason that number is so much smaller in the 09-11 biennium.
That's it. You didn't conclude with, this has been a wonderful experience. I've enjoyed the negotiations. Questions for Mr. Alanuck? Cindy Becker, Lauren Rhodes, Brian Behringer, and Kevin Earls. And Bruce Bishop. Behringer, you have. All right, if he doesn't come up and testify, we're not passing the bill. Whatever order.
We'll let the gentleman go first because he likes to.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls, representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals. And before we begin singing Kumbaya, I wonder if we could get a pitch pipe note so that we start on the right key.
Okay, Chris. We've been waiting all session. He's from Scotland.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have been working long and hard for the past couple of months to develop a package of both financing restorations of Oregon Health Plan cuts, as well as I think some administrative changes that help facilitate a better operational result of these tax programs that have been in place. And we're now at a point where we've developed, I think, a very positive package that we all feel good about. It will extend the provider tax program for a couple more years. And we would like to just be on record as thanking the co-chairs and the chair of the Human Services Subcommittee and Ways and Means and others that have helped us in putting this package together. I'll pass the mic and be happy to respond to questions.
Senator Torch.
Are you guys okay with removing the jurisdiction from the tax court? Oregon tax court? Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Lauren Rhodes, Oregon Healthcare Association, and Senator George, the removal of the tax court jurisdiction applies just to the long-term care facility provider tax, and yes, we are comfortable with that. And I'd like to just echo what Mr. Earle said. We have been in long negotiations with leadership and with the Department of Human Services, and we've come to what we believe is a very acceptable and fair agreement. We do reduce our payment standard for long-term care facilities from the 70th percentile in existing law down to the 63rd, which Chris explained, to the 63rd percentile. And in doing so, we also agreed to extend our tax for six more years through 2014. And that's important to us because it really gives our members the predictability and the stability that they are looking for in terms of budgeting and planning for the future. So those were important provisions for us. We appreciate all the hard work on the part of everyone who's worked through this in the past several months, and we look forward to passing the bill and moving forward. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I'm the director of the Coalition for Healthy Oregon, which represents the Medicaid managed care plans. I would like to echo my health care partners and also like to compliment the co-chairs and Senator Carter. This was a complicated negotiation. I think everyone came to the table trying to get to the best outcomes, and we did that. We think this is a good bill. We support it. We have one little hiccup, which is not a deal breaker for us at all. On page 2, on line 27, there's one change about the funding going from health services to hospital services. As I said, it's not a deal breaker for us at all. We're just going to watch that. Other than that, we support the bill. We think this is a good bill, and we urge your support and moving forward in the legislature. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? And you've seen the Department of Human Services amendment. I just want to get your attention. Make sure you're.
We have, but I don't think anyone else has.
Thank you very much. They don't want to testify. Mr. Behringer, Mr. Bishop, you don't have to if you don't want to. We just feel like this committee doesn't.
Are you serious about amendment?
No, there's no. Oh, okay. There's no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, also appearing on behalf of the Hospital Association. One of the things that wasn't mentioned that I think it's important to bring to your attention is that this bill passed the House yesterday 58-0. That was a significant step, and we're pleased that you're hearing it this morning and hope that the Senate can come pretty close to meeting the House's record in terms of the vote and support for this bill.
We can't come close.
We're not near
enough members.
You're going to be 30 votes off at least.
Come close.
I had always understood that senators had the equivalent of two votes.
That's good. Finally, a little.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brian Behringer with Oregon Health and Science University, and I would like to echo the comments of my colleagues here. We are nothing but a team player, and we also support this package. So, thanks.
Anyone want to discuss that statement? Nothing but a team player, Senator Burdick. Any insight in?
I would just add my voice in agreement with that statement.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on, I know you spent hours and hours, and I saw the conference rooms that y'all inhabited. It wasn't pretty. Close the public hearing on, anyone else on 3057? Open a...
Oh, I thought I saw a hand back there, but I think they were just giving a high five.
Open a work session on House Bill 3057.
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to move the dash 12 amendments? Bad joke. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House Bill 3057A as amended before with a due pass recommendation without the dash 12 amendments.
So we'll leave out the DHS amendments. Senator George has moved House Bill 3057 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objections to that motion? So ordered. Senator Carter and Schrader. Senator Schrader will carry the bill. Open a public hearing, reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3201 because we do have one or two of our amendments is out. We understand we're going to get another set of them about 1 o'clock. 1 o'clock. We should get another amendment. And I'd invite up the nurses sir, to talk about the dash A6s, I believe. Good morning.
Good morning, Chairman Senator Deckard and committee. My name is Darlene Young. I'm an RN. I volunteer with Red Cross. I have volunteered in many other capacities, and I volunteer with a free health clinic in Washington County. But over the years, have done a lot of other things. We are here to ask for a tax credit for our nurses who are volunteering their time, because many nurses, when they retire, give up their license, do not keep up their skills, and in the event of a disaster, in the event of a public health crisis, if we have a pandemic, all kinds of things happen, and these people need to be available. They have the experience, which a brand new nurse out of school doesn't have, and we have very few brand new nurses out of school in comparison to the population anymore because of the shortage of slots available, because our teaching staff is also retiring. Conservative studies estimate that the present critical shortage of nurses is expected to increase to 340,000. This is at three times the current rate of retirement and decrease in nurses over the next 13 years. That's from the January-February 2000 issue of Health Affairs. In 1980, 18% of nurses were under 30 years of age. Even then, staff shortages caused stress in the field. In 2010, 17% will be 50 to 54 years of age, when many of them from burnout decide it's time to go. General population age in the U.S. is rising rapidly, adding to the healthcare problem. Nurses also age and retire, increasing that problem. Retention of educated, experienced, and skilled RNs as volunteers, though not a total answer, is one way to help relieve this shortage while other solutions are developed. The shortage of nursing educators means fewer openings for students in nursing schools. When 1,500 apply and only 200 can be accommodated, our shortage will not soon be solved. Shortage of public health nurses equals disaster, not if, when, and not if a pandemic occurs. Shortage equals increased understaffing in hospitals and in facilities serving the aged or disabled. A shortage equals fewer experienced in special skills as case managers, quality assessment, nurse ombudsman, and patient advocates. Shortage means even fewer nurses available for VA hospitals where increasing numbers of returning veterans need care. And we have a very serious problem, and I'm sure you all know about the Wounded Warrior Bill in Washington, D.C. How long do you think it will take to get something effective coming out of Washington, D.C.? We need to do something in our own state. A shortage means unavailable trained school health nurses who serve a vital role in health counseling, care, and teaching students healthy lifestyles to decrease later health burdens for the public. Shortage means fewer nurses available for community health centers, free clinics, parish nurse programs, Red Cross, and other disaster-related needs. In a nation and a world in crisis, it is unthinkable that we could recognize having such a resource, education enhanced by experience, maturity in decision-making processes, and not encourage them to continue to use their skills as volunteers. These nurses are an untapped wealth waiting to continue their compassionate care for the public at no salary. Greater numbers might be encouraged to maintain their licenses and skills and volunteer by offering the incentive of a small tax credit, and with careful consideration from a background of having been born in the Depression and grown up during that time. I'm probably older than anybody else in this room. And having considered this very carefully, and my husband and I are on a fixed income, that is read not fixed but broken. That is what it is when you get a fixed income. We pay our taxes, and we are glad to pay them. But what we are asking for is a pittance in comparison of the value that will be received. Oregon has been a leader in the nation in so many ways previously. Let us now show them how to help the underserved in health care, our returning wounded warriors, citizens suffering disaster, public health crises, and all the other areas where volunteer nurses can make such a difference. Do you have questions?
Well, we're trying to get a, we're asking staff if they've done a revenue impact on this, on your amendment at this point. Question, Senator George.
I'm sorry, I don't understand this because I've served on health policy committees, but if you allow your license to go dormant, is it like a pilot's license where you're not current but you still have a license, or you lose the license?
No, you lose it.
That's what I thought was the case. Now, why don't we do that, a dormancy license in which you can be brought back in under those emergency circumstances?
Because you need to keep your skills up.
Correct.
You don't want to be in the hospital and have somebody who has not kept their skills up taking care of you, believe me.
Is it a very extensive process to get back into the system?
Yes.
Okay, now that's my
Barry.
Point. Yeah. Because, like, for example, I'm going to use a pilot's license. Obviously, you want a competent person in the air.
Right.
But what happens is they understand that you know how to fly an airplane, and you probably have a good idea what the laws are. So in order to be current, they put you through the physical and then, you know, all the rest of it, and make sure your training is understood, and then recertify you as current. Why not a system like that for nurses, so that we knew that we had a reserve force, let's call it that, of nurses that could, in fact, be brought back online in a hurry and emergency?
We would like to have a reserve force of nurses online, and this might encourage that happening. But to lose your license, in order to get back into nursing, you have to go through a reentry program, which includes the entire spectrum of nursing again. And this, it's not a simple thing to do, and it is time-consuming. And if you have a public health crisis, if we have a pandemic, we can all, without our licenses, run down the street and throw the vaccine through your window and say, give yourself your own shot, but we cannot give it to you. And there's not time to train you, to train us at that point. And the new, all the new technologies coming out, there are so many changes, and I would not go back to work at this point in ICU again, because there have been so many changes in the last 20 years since I worked there. I would not feel competent. I would have to put myself through a special period of training before I would feel comfortable. You have someone's life in your hands. Mm-hmm. I know when you are a pilot, because I have flown too, when you are a pilot, you have people's lives in your hands, sometimes only your own. Mm-hmm. But if you are taking care of someone in a medical situation, you have a life in your hands, and you have to be really competent.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for indulging this. I really think we need to talk to the Nurses Association, particularly with retired, during the interim, in the Emergency Preparedness Committee. Because, you don't need to be in intensive care if, in fact, you have the talent, which is going to be there forever,
right,
to be coming back in that emergency, in that pandemic, to be able to be of great service. And if we can, if we could have a sustaining license that, in fact, we would be able to be very low fee to maintain this lower level license, I really think that would be smart, and particularly where we could keep you guys back in the volunteering thing to stay relatively current with some sort of tax credit.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing about Red Cross and parish nurses, we don't do the hands-on care anymore. We do the education piece, and we do the Barbara Fritz, for the record. We do advocacy and education. And so we don't need to maintain critical skills to keep our licenses, but we still need to demonstrate competencies in that specialty and have continuing experience, and they are going to increase the continuing education unit requirements, et cetera. So I don't think there's a shortcut to what you're suggesting, which would be nice. So we're kind of suggesting a long way to avoid that, of losing the licenses in the first place.
Questions for Ms.
Chair.
Sarah
Perdick. These ladies have really worked hard on this issue. One of them is my constituent, and I forget which one, so I claim them all. And you've done an amazing amount of work on this. And as I recall, when you first came to see me, you had kind of a rough revenue estimate of what this would cost, because you were asking.
Yes,
Mr.
we brought it, and
we should have a piece of paper here today for you that we left at the desk.
And is that your revenue estimate, or is it ours?
It's ours.
It's yours.
It's ours.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was an outline which we gave to the revenue department so that they could do an estimate for you.
And Alice has that to go over with you today if you'd like to have us do that.
And do you remember roughly what the impact was, what the total cost would be?
Alice, do you want to?
My name is Alice McCarthy. And we sort of figured with the number of volunteers that we contacted all the counties in the state of Oregon to find out their number of volunteers. We called the public health departments. We checked with Red Cross. I contacted the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and they do have a limitation of liability group. And I think you also have this paper there, don't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Where they have 79 people that are listed in there, but the prior year they had 150, and you have to renew that part every year. But we figured kind of at the rate of $500 for 100 hours of nursing, volunteer nursing, it would be around $272,000 per year for the number of nurses that we felt were actual volunteers. And if you do it on the 2-year biennium, it would be $544,000. And if, you know, this might, this kind of covers what it costs you to keep up liability insurance, what it costs you to renew your license, that this would help some of the nurses to stay possibly into doing volunteer work because not all of their expenses would be met, certainly, but at least part of them would and be some encouragement towards that.
Thanks for asking.
Other questions for this panel? So we're going to keep working this bill. What I've asked Chris to do, who does our income tax for legislative revenues, A, to get us a revenue impact, B, to put a sunset on your amendment. We sunset all of our tax credits just so that we come back and look at them. But that, at least at that point, you have something that if the committee decides to include you in the final tax cut package or tax credit package, you have the things that you would need, which would be first a revenue impact from LRO, getting a sunset into your amendment. I've said 4 years for staff.
That's great. Yes.
Just to get you at least the possibility of being included.
Chairman Deckert, we did not think about a sunset amendment at the time we were working on this, but we realized after it was done that we really needed a sunset amendment in there. I think that's the only reasonable way to, you know, I'm not going to tell my children that they can go to college and I will pay for everything through their doctorate if my husband and I are still on a fixed income. They are expected to do something and to prove that they are making a good effort and a worthwhile effort.
Great. So. Well, thank you. Any other questions? And we are just so impressed. So many folks are at council trying to get amendments to 3201. And the fact that y'all made it first after all these well-paid lobbyists whose job it is to understand the inner machinations of this building, and you beat them all to the punch, I think is a wonderful, still haven't figured it out, but it is a wonderful statement about your diligence.
This is our persistence.
But we may not all be back again.
Well, it's a great statement that you...
We may need
the
nurses.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
for
you. Thank you.
Thank you. Jack, your amendment actually is ready, so you can claim credit over your peers in the business.
Actually, if you want to leave the fine nurses up here to testify to the merits of this, we all may be better off. Chairman Deckert, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp. I appear before you today on behalf of the Software Association of Oregon, and we are bringing the -A6 amendments to House Bill 3201. These amendments began life in this assembly as House Bill 2779. Our goal in proposing House Bill 2779 was to create a tax incentive for businesses like those of our member companies who have tremendous capability for upside on payroll, but do not have deep or particularly pronounced needs for physical capital. And if you look at the economic development incentives that we have on the books, in the main, they are skewed largely towards property tax abatements and relief on capital equipment acquisition for very good economic reasons. But the practical effect of that for many of our members is that we are unable to participate in some of those incentives. And in fact, our members are able to participate in incentives that are at work in other states and nearby jurisdictions. And one of the leading examples is up in British Columbia and was part of the incentive for us to take up this bill. They have a very targeted incentive that's much more aggressive than what we're proposing here. It's a payroll-based incentive for software engineers, and they've managed to grow a tremendous industry cluster in Vancouver, British Columbia, around gaming, software for the gaming industry, the video game industry. This is also similar to incentives that are in operation being used successfully in Arkansas, Florida, Indiana, Maine, and Nebraska. What we're proposing here, this bill was worked extensively in the policy committee in the House, Workforce and Economic Development, and really I think they helped us tremendously in improving the bill, focusing its application, and making sure what we proposed was a very limited pilot program. So I think we fashioned many sidebars around the incentive we're trying to create to make sure it both affects the targets, the types of businesses we want to affect, and doesn't reach beyond that, and also is something that we can come back and evaluate to determine whether or not we want to expand it or curtail it. To briefly address those limitations, the Economic Development Department will certify employers who can participate in this program. We've limited the certifications to 40 per biennium. The participants in this program must be not only be creating payroll, but they must be creating high-wage payroll. The payroll criteria for the job creation must be 150% of the county per capita income in the county where the company is seeking certification. They must also be net job creators. They must create 5 new jobs in the state. They must retain those 5 new jobs. They can't shift jobs within the state and take advantage of the credit. The credit sunsets in 2013, and it features some strict clawback provisions. The concept has the support of the Oregon Economic Development Association, which, as many of you know, is an association of economic development professionals in the state. They're really our feet on the street in terms of economic development throughout the state. They're the ones who are most directly involved in fulfillment of economic development requests, and I think many times can offer us a very relevant and timely perspective on the types of incentives that can help them execute their jobs better. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions from the committee, and I'll leave it there.
Great. Questions, and you're the president of the Software Association, just right. Harvey, do you want to, Matt, do you want to join Jack and say anything, or we can go right to see if there's questions?
Thank you, Chair Deckard, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Harvey Matthews, the president of the Software Association of Oregon. This is a very exciting time in software development in Oregon. We are adding a lot of jobs, and we are positioning our state against not only the nation but the rest of the world as being a development center for many software elements. This is starting to be recognized by the Economic Development Department, and Jack probably mentioned our economic impact statement and how that showed us as a very important cluster in the state. This amendment, I think, will enable the state to, once we make these gains in jobs, to retain these gains in jobs should the industry plateau. And I think positioning ourselves, looking forward to that eventuality, is very critical. You obviously understand the boom and bust cycle of the general fund and how that impacts the state, and we have the same important function here with regards to jobs in the software industry. We can not only add these jobs, but retain them, and I think that's why this amendment is very important for the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Matthews. Questions for this panel? Chris, have we been able to do a revenue impact on this?
I've been looking at 2779, and there's a dash A2 to 2779 that had the certification starting later than this amendment does. Or is it?
What is your time? What is your time period?
It was October in the original bill.
Yeah, October.
And I think we're we were trying just to work to get some consistency in this bill, but we're flexible in terms of the October was designed to impact the revenue analysis, although Mr. Alanok may be able to address that better, how much that 10-month period.
It runs through 2013 and then would sunset in 2013.
The department cannot issue certifications after 2013.
December.
So with this date, I was getting a revenue impact in the neighborhood of around $3 million for 07-09. Again, I had looked at this earlier. That was the original 2779, and then I was focusing my attention on the Dash A2 of 2779, which had moved the certifications to October 1, 2000. Moved them later to 09, and so it almost eliminated the impact for 07-09. So the timing.
So just to be clear, we're not going to eliminate the impact. I mean, if there is a legitimate timing issue of when you could actually certify them, which I'll leave it open to the committee, but I would think October would be legitimate of 07, or perhaps.
Of 07, yeah.
Well, we can defer.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, in discussions with. This will be a new program and require rulemaking and economic development. The folks we dealt with over there thought, the earliest they'd probably be out marketing it would be, around the first year.
January 1st.
Yeah. So I think that was another driver when we put this amendment into the current bill, was we just do it in January.
I'm sorry, I was just going to clarify then that the revenue impact that I was getting was about the $3 million figure.
Based on
the earlier dates.
So, Senator Starr, I don't know if you have a chance. You have done some of this work to work with economic development and the proponents of this amendment just to hunt down that issue of when the soonest we could start it after legitimate time for rulemaking, marketing, or whatever, the soonest that we could begin it. So that we're not just punting it out to avoid a revenue impact. This, and if you did need to further amend the bill, that would need to be done as quick as possible.
Okay.
Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Decker.
Okay, we're under a call. Correct. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill, or recess the public hearing on House Bill 3201. We may get H.J.R. 13 back in committee for, because I don't see David here. Oh, and Christine, you have your amendment ready. Are we under a call or a call?
Real call, a real call or a fake call?
Yeah, exactly. When we get up there and they say we didn't need you, so we'll come. Yes, we'll come back at 1:45. It looks like we'll have H.J.R. 13 for some sort of conflict amendment, and then we'll return as people get their amendments. Hopefully by 1:30, 1:45 today. We're adjourned until 1:40. Recessed until 1:45, and it could be in hearing room B. Or